tomorrow. As recorded before a live audience in Pasadena, California, Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
When I was over offshore Korea in 1950 during the Korean War on a United States aircraft carrier, I learned a little bit of a lesson about we human beings as to the very quick ability of our adaptation. I think I even learned a little bit about the Bible statement that says, they which were brought up in scarlet or in purple shall embrace dunghills. I don't mean anything at all about Navy Chow. I'm talking about something that happened when I was loading, because we would have these other vessels come alongside when our bomb group had expended a lot of our ammunition, bombs and rockets. And the first time I ever had duty to go down there in the holds and to be sliding bombs around on metal, I really began to sit a little bit light. I began to think, what if one of these things went off? We would load 2,000-pound bombs. You know what those are, the blockbuster type, great huge things. 1,000, 500-pounders, 100-pounders. If you prided yourself on weightlifting a little bit, what you could stand, they didn't have fins on them, and they had protectors around them, but no fuses in. But you just pass them from one to the other and load them. The rest of them use chains and hoists and so on. So I have worked by the hours loading boxes of fuses, which are very volatile, and all sizes of rockets and bombs and so on. And so finally, as we were waiting between loads coming down the elevators on one occasion, while we would take a little time out for a cat nap, and I stretched out on the back of a great big 2,000-pound bomb and put my jacket underneath my head as a pillow and went completely to sleep. And I was thinking a little later on, it didn't really make any difference to me whether the thing went off while I was up above on the flight deck or whether I was down there in the area where we stored the bombs, because I probably wouldn't have lived very long in either occasion. But it just struck me at how quickly we human beings can adapt to what would seem to be a very dangerous situation and then take it for granted. After a few hours, and certainly after a few months, of acquaintanceship with guns and bombs and things like that all around you all the time, you're walking along the hangar deck and you're seeing up on the flight deck the bombs on their trundles and people are loading them and rockets on the aircraft, machine guns everywhere. They don't look deadly or dangerous to you anymore. You take them for granted. This world is in a condition much like I was, asleep serenely on that 2,000-pound bomb. I was as comfortable as I could be. I took it for granted. I didn't think the thing would go off. It didn't have a fuse in it. I felt just about as safe as if I had been up in my bunk. And we, in this world, go to sleep aboard a huge bomb capable of exterminating every man, woman, and child on the face of the earth every night. And it's getting a lot worse instead of any better. Now, recently, some sensational information has been coming out about the fact that the Russians seem to be achieving strategic superiority, not just parity or equality, but superiority over the United States. Following the Cold War, when the announcement came out in 1949 that the Russians had exploded an atomic bomb, and later in 1950 that they had the hydrogen bomb, there was never really a decision made in Washington, but that Moscow's reaction was not taken into account. Whether you talk of the war in Korea, which ended fruitlessly with everything just as it was, with the expenditure of billions of dollars and thousands and tens of thousands of lives, whether you talk of the most agonizing war in which the United States was ever involved, our longest, our most costly, and in terms of tonnages of bombs, we expended more bombs on empty landscape in North Vietnam than we ever did on all those cities in the central part of the Ruhr. It was an enormous war, and yet we lost. And South Vietnam is firmly in the hands of a communist government today. There has not been a major decision from the Bay of Pigs to the Pueblo incident where our government has not had to take into consideration what would be the Soviet response. Now, up to the time of the Kennedy administration and the calculated risk, and if you saw the movie a little later on, the special that came out on television of all the behind-the-scenes wrangling around between the Kennedy brothers and their hotline to the Kremlin, and Khrushchev's reaction, you know that once again, even in the Bay of Pigs, there was a tremendous amount of input into the White House with regard to what the Russian response might be. Our armed forces were placed on full alert. There was an absolute scare or a fright that went across the United States in cities and towns. People began to fill their bathtubs with emergency water supply, and there were tens of thousands of Americans that really thought a nuclear bomb, World War III, was just immediately in the offing. It didn't come about because in that calculated risk, we won. Why did we win? Well, for several reasons, not the least of which is simply the understanding of the Russian temperament, that they will bluster, they will push, and they will continue to shove to try to get their way, and only when you stand up to them, only when you really push back a little harder than they push, will they turn away a little while and try to find some other way to pursue their objective. But there was another reason, too, because American policy following World War II was to build up a nuclear arsenal for defense alone. Now, I know we have offensive weapons, but those offensive weapons are strategic weapons based upon our Minuteman system, which is land-based, and our Poseidon system, which is sea-based, in our nuclear submarines. Those are not intercontinental, but intermediate-range ballistic missiles capable of being fired either from above or beneath the sea, and you're well aware of that fact. And I hope of the fact, too, that the Soviet Union has three times as many missile-carrying submarines as we have. But our policy was not to build a strategic nuclear power, which would be offensive, but defensive, so that in the event of a nuclear attack, our civil defense budget, our deployment eventually on up into the late 60s even until it was scrapped, of an ABM system to defend the civilian population would follow the Washington policy of being able to absorb a first blow, hopefully to turn away many of them, or most of them, to even intercept missiles up in the space above the stratosphere and explode them harmlessly up there, and then to deal the Soviet Union such a massive retaliatory blow that the whole thought, the whole concept of nuclear war was simply unthinkable to both parties. Until a matter of a very few weeks ago, that was the way it seemed to be. Nuclear stalemate. The United States had destructive capability to the point that the virtual eradication of major Russian population and industrial centers would render the idea of any Soviet adventurism in a nuclear attack unthinkable. But that was based upon the idea that our Minuteman land-based system would hit its target in the Soviet Union, all of its many targets, and that our Poseidon submarines, the missiles aboard them, would also hit their target. Now there have been some new developments. In the last few weeks, it has been determined that our Minuteman land-based strategic missile system may well be virtually obsolete. Apparently, the Soviet Union has been devoting massive billions of dollars, far more than the United States, to its defense program. That is, its civilian defense program. Apparently, they have now come up with a brand new radar, which has delicate missile jamming systems, so that the missile sensors, which would be guiding missiles to their targets, would be confused, so that our land-based missiles, even if they were launched in a retaliatory attack upon the Soviet Union, would never reach their target. Secondly, they have been claiming for some years that for every building they construct above ground, they construct another one below ground. That whole population centers, massive industry, weapons manufacturing centers, and where the people live who work in those centers are being built underground in the Soviet Union, as we in the United States have many missile centers completely underground, as you know. Another very important development has come along, and that is that the Soviet Union has vast superiority in the area of submarines, 3-1 at least. Now, in the last few years, when we realized we had a little bit of superiority, at least we thought, in what is called strategic missiles, such as the short-range and the intermediate and the long-range big multi-megaton hydrogen bombs, we began to realize we were falling behind in tactical as well as in conventional weapons. And so the United States embarked upon a policy of building additional tactical weapons. Now that has to do with the B-1 bomber. You've heard of the Russian backfire bomber, the answer or the response to that. It has to do with such things as even troop-carried missiles and the long Tom cannon with a small yield kiloton range warhead or so. It has to do with the more conventional weapons, such as our big, beautiful swing-wing F-14 that is now replacing the F-111 and has rendered the F-4 Phantom obsolete. When I went up to Point Mugu and saw a ground static test and then saw one of the first takeoffs, I guess, in the training program, where Grumman was about to deliver the F-14 Tomcat to the Navy, I learned a little bit about that airplane, but not as much as I learned a little later on when some of the statistics were released. By way of comparison, I was telling my wife recently, you know how long it takes us to get to 35,000 feet in the Fanjet Falcon? And she said, well, about 35 minutes, doesn't it? I said, yes, that's right, on a good day. That's a very good climb schedule for a Falcon, especially if you're heavy in the cabin. About a minute per 1,000 feet. You start out at maybe 4,000 feet a minute initially. You taper off to 2,000 feet a minute up till about maybe flight level 230, and it might fall clear off out of 310 to 500 feet or less. But it averages out about 1,000 feet a minute to 35,000 feet. It's faster than that in a 707. I asked her, do you know what it takes the Grumman Gulfstream II to get to 41,000 feet? No. What does it? I said, 14 minutes from a standing start at the end of the runway, as opposed to 35 minutes. She said, wow, that is really something. I said, it sure is. That is one hot airplane. That's kind of like the same climb figures that you have on one of these 24D Learjets, the private fighter airplane that people call a corporate jet that everybody wants to get a hold of, quite a pilot's airplane. But I said, guess how fast an F-14 climbs? And she didn't know. Well, I didn't either, though. I read it in the papers, or in a magazine, rather. I said, it takes the F-14 to go to 98,000 feet just under 3.5 minutes. To 98,000 feet. The other day, a friend of mine told about a friend of his who was riding in the back seat of one of those things, took off out of Miramar, pointed the nose straight up, and went through supersonic, going straight up. Unbelievable. It's like literally riding atop a missile with wings out there. But the interesting thing to me is that these unbelievably fast supersonic swing-wing aircraft, fighter bombers with several different separate systems in them, it takes a couple of technicians with, I guess, marvelous training to operate them because they have ground-sensing radar so that they can fly along absolutely blind over the mountains. They have heat-seeking missiles and infrared equipment. They've got sidewinders that are very now a new generation developed. They have all types of weapons where they can kill an enemy bomber, I guess, many, many miles away and never even see the thing. But we are delivering these to the Shah of Iran. We are sending them over to Saudi Arabia. We are giving them away and selling them to countries around the world. West Germany has got an order in. We're going to be giving them away to nations all over the world, and in some cases before our own military units can get them. You know, years ago, when I was a teenager, the only way the enemy or potential enemy countries ever knew the United States had a new weapon system was when it appeared in the skies over their cities. The Germans didn't have the faintest idea we had fighters capable of escorting B-17Es all the way to Berlin until they were over Berlin. We sure didn't sell them any. We sure didn't send any to Italy. We weren't giving them away to the Arabs. But those earlier aircraft, the P-39 Aircobras and B-40s, and finally, a little later on, some of the other aircraft that came along in the middle part of World War II, the ones the British had, of course, the Hurricanes and Spitfires, they couldn't go all the way to Berlin. They'd go about halfway and turn back. And it's easy for the enemy to figure out what is the best time to send its fighters aloft to hit the bombers. It's just after the short-range escort turns back. So that's the way the war went for the first half or so in Europe. It wasn't until, I think, about the middle of 1944, wasn't it? Or early 44, until we had those long-range fighters capable of staying right with the bombers all the way to Berlin and back. The P-38 Lightning, the F-47 or P-47 Thunderbolts, and the F-51. And they helped win the war for us. But when we had secret or new developments in weapons, we sure enough weren't in the arms business to sell them to potential or to actual enemies like we are today. Well, for years, we turned our attention, it seemed, to development of some of the tactical and to some of the conventional weapons systems. We have helicopters now that are capable of operating in totally zero-zero, that's blind visibility, deep, thick ground fog, visibility 1 inch, you know, and they can operate, they can fly, and they can deliver mortars or bazookas or rockets or missiles or what have you to their target. We have developed in the United States hovercraft. They sure beat the Higgins boats, the LCTs and LVIs of World War II, because you can load them with troops, and those troops can have infrared rifles and rockets on their rifles, and even carry small rockets that will kill a great big Tiger tank. And you can take those troops, and they can be launched at sea and hover over a cushion of air and go right up over the beach and the sand dunes and the small hills and keep going inland in a hovercraft. Guess who's learning how to operate those things? Turks, Iranians, Arabs over in Saudi Arabia. Now we have a brand new missile-carrying destroyer, very, very fast, called a Forrestal class, after former Secretary of the Navy years ago. They're delivering those to some of those other countries, but our Navy can't get any yet. They're a little behind in their orders, and our Navy is a little behind in getting its first units delivered to the fleet so our own Navy can find out how to experiment with them. The next administration, the new administration in Washington, are going to have to consider, according to recent publications, four, and it's interesting to see what they leave out, but four major possibilities. One is the fact of our Minuteman vulnerability, and some means will have to be developed to either protect the present land-based Minuteman force. Now, we spent billions upon billions of dollars on the ABM deployment and then scrapped it. That came out of tax money. That was what kept the artificial balloon of our economy going. That was why the government printing offices kept producing more and more bills that are worth practically less than nothing. All you can do is apparently warm your hands with them when all comes down to barter society. But it kept us going for a while. The first Soviet strike now might simply be unable to be absorbed by our own populaces because we don't have the same protection we thought we did have. The Soviet Union now apparently has achieved, through that portable radar missile jamming system, the capability to survive up to 90% in the case of a United States missile strike. I think the closest they have come to any estimation of United States survivability in the event of a nuclear attack is perhaps two-thirds or less. Most of them have tended to say about a third of the population of the United States of America would disappear as a result of the first initial missile strike. So, the new administration in Washington is going to have to come up with some answers about either protecting that Minuteman missile deployment or coming up with some newer, lightweight, portable, movable system which would replace it. And that might be the second option, which would be a counterforce threat. Greatly expanded research and development program is being advocated by some U.S. experts to improve the accuracy and the explosive power of U.S. missiles. So far, we only have multi-megatons. A megaton is 1 million tons. 1 million tons of TNT explosive equivalent. And when you got 20 megatons, that's not enough. You need 100, 200, 1,000. We have the potential. People argue about whether we can destroy the Soviet Union 20 times over and they us 20 times over, or whether it's 50 times over. And they argue about our capability. But now one of the decisions in Washington is whether or not we need higher yield explosive missiles, which would include the design of a new weapon known as MARV, a maneuverable warhead that could be guided directly to its target. The aim would be to confront the Russians with a threat to their land-based missiles comparable to the threat that they pose to America's ICBM force. Also, more accurate missiles would have to be designed to zero in directly on those underground cities and defense areas and manufacturing centers and missile sites in the Soviet Union, thus countering the Soviet civil defense force. Third would be cruise missiles. Now, the Soviets have been making a lot of noise. They don't like the idea of cruise missiles. Those would be, by the way, superbly accurate pilotless aircraft released either from submarines, surface vessels, or aircraft, which could then cruise to their target. Was very accurate because they'd be moving at far lower speeds and so on, but they would have, of course, jamming devices for anti-ballistic missiles and all that type of thing. The Russians, in the SALT II negotiations, have been attempting to frustrate any further development of cruise missiles because, of course, that might mean the United States once again had achieved strategic superiority. The fourth option that might face the new administration would be, listen to this one, make China a semi-ally. Now, here's the nation of Red China, where you have heard published in the United States reports of gigantic numbers of up to millions, some people have claimed, of human beings who have lost their lives in communist purges as the communists took that nation over, and as millions upon millions of uncounted people were herded away into concentration camps or into Outer Mongolia to put to work in labor camps or simply were put to death, just as in Hitler's Germany. So one of the options now they're saying that is left open to our leaders in Washington would be to make China an ally of the United States of America. Isn't that interesting? Oriental religion. But you see, if it is expedient enough, that would be all you would need as rationale behind making China a semi-ally. Now, there wasn't any fifth proposition, you know, some things such as, now don't laugh, try to hang on so you don't really just fall apart. Like number five, trust in God. Now you see, some of you couldn't contain yourself. You laughed in spite of yourself. That's all right, I know how you feel. That's the way most people would feel about it in the United States of America. Trust in God? That's the worst possible news you can give anybody. I mean, when a patient is lying on the operating table and the nurses turn around, kind of cry a little bit, and the doctor turns off all the valves and takes his fevered brow and takes the mask off and pulls his rubber gloves off and says, well, only God can save him now. What's the patient do? Oh, no, doc, don't tell me that. Save me. Don't leave me here to die. If he turns around and says, only God can save him now, it's the worst news you can give a patient. He knows he's had it. There's no use trusting because he's dead. He's as good as dead. The doctor can't help him. No, to actually seriously suggest that the leadership of the United States of America ought to trust in God sounds very humorous, sounds too religious. So let's get back to the potential nuclear war. That's what we've been talking about for years anyway. Jesus said in Luke 21 and verse 36, watch you therefore and pray always that you might be accounted worthy to escape. And then he said, all these things. What did he want us to pray to escape? Jesus talked about a time in both Matthew 24 and Luke 21 where human annihilation would become a distinct possibility. I've gone over that prophecy so many hundreds of times and tell people, look, Jesus did not come just to establish a first century religion. He didn't come to be a talisman to you. He didn't come to be your blanket like in the peanut strip. He didn't come to be your thumb or your teething ring. He didn't come to give world religions a different religion as opposed to Oriental religions, to get you in church, to keep kids off the street in Sunday school programs. He did not come as a bright young boy who knew better than his father to overthrow his law and make it easy for us Christians to avoid obeying God. Very few people seem to realize Jesus talked about world government, that he talked about the practicality of the survivability of the human race, that he talked about a potential for the destruction of all of humankind, that if God didn't step in and intervene in what man was planning, the time would come when not a man, woman, or baby would be left alive on the face of the earth. He was way ahead of the movie called On the Beach. He was way ahead of some of the science fiction novels that talk about the potential annihilation of all humanity except maybe one man and seven women. You've heard some of the stories. But Jesus talked about that potential. In Matthew 24, he talked about wars and rumors of wars. In Luke 21 and verse 9, he said, when you hear of wars and commotions, be not terrified. Check your newspaper. Yesterday, check it tomorrow. Check it again when you get home today. And what have we been living with since you have been alive, since you have come to know the meaning of the English language, since you could read a newspaper? Practically everything you read and hear of is war and rumor of war. But just like I was in sliding bombs along metal decks and wondering what happens if one goes off, just like I was in working around just tons and boxes of missiles and rockets and bombs and getting completely accustomed to them to the point I could lie down and go to sleep. I mean completely untroubled sleep right on the top of a 2,000-pound bomb. Why, we've heard so much talk about wars and commotions and riots and rumors of wars and nations toppling and men being assassinated in positions of leadership. We've had so much of that happen right in the United States of America in the last few decades, where in the 1960s there were more soldiers with fixed bayonets confronting American citizens than there were American soldiers confronting North Vietnamese. We're used to it. We're accustomed to it. We're callous to it. So there isn't any real reason for Jesus, perhaps, to tell us today, when you hear of wars and rumors of wars or commotions, riots, upsets, be not terrified. Nobody's terrified anymore. But you know, there is no such thing as a small war to those who are involved in it. It's only a small war to the newscasters and the people at home watching it over television. Then it's a small war. It's a faraway war. To the kids up at Mile Lot in the schoolhouse, it was a big war because they were right there. And the bullets were crackling around and sometimes smacking into a body next to them. To those people aboard that captured Air France Airbus, when they began to single out the other nationalities and they realized, you Israelis go over here and you Europeans go over there. That wasn't just a little bemusing incident that they could read about from far away with morning toast and coffee. It was their lives, it was their immediate future, their destiny, and they were really beginning to become frightened and terrified. When you hear of wars, be not terrified, for these things must first come to pass, but the end. Now, you've heard of people talk about the end. A lot of people claim that we believe in the end of the world, and I've tried to say on dozens of broadcasts, we believe in no such thing. Jesus said that he is going to intervene, that there won't be any end of civilization, that mankind will survive, that civilization as we know it will change, it will alter, there will begin to be a new and a different age, a new and a different kind of government. The end, though, Jesus did talk about. Not the end of the earth or the end of all of humankind, but the end of present civilization. Have other civilizations come to an end? Can you go to the shattered monuments of once proud civilizations that had status of empire? Can't you go over into the area of the Mediterranean, to Rome, to Greece? Can't you go to Turkey and up into the area of northern Israel and see the relics? Can't you see them in Africa and in Europe? What about lost Atlantis? What about great civilizations such as Babylonia, Persia, Media? What about the Ming Dynasty and all of the hundreds and hundreds of years where great civilizations that could come to build monuments so unbelievable that modern-day architects and engineers would be absolutely impossibly challenged to even try to reproduce something like that? How would you like to be the contractor to build the Great Wall around China today? How would you like to be the contractor to be told, I want you to build me a pyramid? How about if you were the builder who were told to build me the walls of Babylon with its hanging gardens and a river running through the town? Those were great civilizations. They lasted for longer in many cases than up to, you know, twice, four times, five times, in some cases maybe 10 times as long as the United States has been a nation. The end, though, Jesus did talk about. Not the end of the earth or the end of all of humankind, but the end of present civilization. The end of present ways of governing human beings. The end of present ways of living. The end of present lifestyle.
This topic will be continued on the next edition in series of The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong. You're invited to learn more about these important issues through the pages of Good News Magazine. This full-color monthly publication underscores the importance of biblical understanding in modern 20th century living. The Good News Magazine. Your subscription is free of charge. There is no cost or obligation. The Good News. You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your requests along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Or you may dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444.